Annie Mayshan is a former British MI5 intelligence officer who is now an author, public speaker, media pundit, political campaigner, and the European Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. If there's anything else that I left out, please mention it. But thank you for joining us, Ms. Mayshan. Our first question is regarding the connection between Western intelligence and government with radical Islam, starting with Al-Qaeda back in the 1980s. Now, some mainstream academic terrorism experts dismiss or severely downplay the connection between Al-Qaeda and the CIA or MI6, where they say the West only supported the Mujahideen and not what was later known as Al-Qaeda. From your experience, which you've written about in your book, can you briefly tell us what exactly is this historical connection between Western governments and specifically Al-Qaeda?
I think they're just playing with semantics here, because they've always known that there is a radical stream of Islam out there. And I think that we need to pedal back a little bit into history, where UK and other Western democracies and the US have always had an interest, a growing interest in the Middle East, because they're energy rich. They have had for decades now. And one of the first manifestations of their influence in that area was in 1953 with the coup, which was orchestrated by the CIA and MI6. And this has been acknowledged by those agencies now. The coup in Iran against the democratically elected President Mossadegh in 1953. And that replaced a democratically elected president with someone who became the Shah of Iran and was an authoritarian dictator, tortured people, but he was basically secular. A bit like Colonel Gaddafi of Libya and President Saddam Hussein in Iraq and President Assad in Syria. So he was a sort of odious dictator, but served Western needs. Now, he was overthrown in 1979 with a Shia Islamist coup, which did not suit the Americans at all. And ever since then, they've been sort of undermining any sort of real notional democracy across the Middle East. So come the 1980s, where there was no chance to attack Russia, the Soviet Union in those days, in its involvement in the war in Afghanistan. Yes, sure, the Americans started supplying the Taliban, as it became, with weapons to try and wear down the Soviet Union, and it succeeded. And of course, from the 1980s situation in Afghanistan, all the other problems with Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, whatever, have metastasized since then. So effectively, I think the West has created a many-headed hydra that it can no longer control. So it thought it would be useful, but it can't do it now. And we're seeing a meltdown in the Middle East because of that.
So in the 1980s, the West had armed and trained the Mujahideen as a proxy against the Soviets. And by 1988, Al-Qaeda was formally created. But in the 1990s, did the West continue to conscious intent to continue this relationship?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, there have been hugely close links between the Bin Laden family and some of the oligarchs in America. That's beyond question. I mean, Nafiz Ahmed is a very good researcher into this, and he saw that. MI5 saw Al-Qaeda as an emerging threat by 1995. They set up a section to deal with it. MI6, on the other hand, at the same time, saw them as a useful tool, so was funding them. So you have two separate organisations of British intelligence working in absolute contradiction to each other, which is nothing new, but, you know, considering what's happened since, it's actually rather frightening. And I think it's been very interesting, particularly over the last few months, where the 28 pages of the 9/11 Commission were finally published after years of campaigning by the authors of that Commission report, which do show quite how deeply embedded the Saudi regime was with Al-Qaeda. And the fact that they tried to cover this up so much for so long is interesting in itself. It says a lot in itself.
And I thought I'd backtrack a bit, because I believe in your book you mentioned how you discovered and David that MI6 had given $100,000 to Al-Qaeda to carry out a foreign assassination of Gaddafi, which failed. And at the time, Robin Cook, the foreign secretary, he didn't believe it. He didn't investigate it. But later in the later years, I found quotes of Robin Cook that seemed to be a 180. Do you know anything about that? Where he was saying that Al-Qaeda, an organized Al-Qaeda, doesn't really exist. I mean, can you comment on that apparent turn that he had?
Well, I think all the evidence had been there for a long time. I mean, he, as foreign secretary, when David Shaler was being investigated and they tried to extradite him from Paris for trying to expose this illegal assassination attempt against a foreign head of state, which went wrong and killed innocent people. I mean, how much more heinous can you get? So he tried to cover that up as foreign secretary. But other evidence came out. And of course, Robin Cook was against the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. So perhaps it all began to come together for him at that time. But I think he had more of a sense of what was going on. And we saw from 2004, I mean, this is after Robin Cook died, we saw from 2004 that Tony Blair made a dodgy deal in the desert with Colonel Gaddafi, where Colonel Gaddafi was supposed to give up his non-existent weapons of mass destruction. And he was welcomed back into the international fold. And yet then when Gaddafi became a player again, he was, of course, invaded and murdered in 2011. We have a terrible situation with that. And look at Libya now. You know, it's sectarian. The quality of life has gone down for virtually every citizen in the country. ISIS has a certain stronghold there. I mean, it's just such a mess.
And just a final comment on bin Laden and Al-Qaeda before we move on to Syria and other topics. But there's a long list of sources and testimonies by experts that believe bin Laden died in 2001 or 2002, either from his sickness or from the bombings in the Tora Bora Mountains. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Nothing personally, no. I mean, I know that Professor David Ray Griffin did quite a lot of research into this, but it's not something I would like to speculate about.
And what can you say about the role of the media and the dissemination of all of this information? Because on one hand, they tell us that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are this evil boogeyman that we must eradicate. But on the other hand, we see all these declassified documents and experts such as yourself, British intelligence, U.S. general like Michael Flynn recently said that the Pentagon knew it was assisting ISIS with its actions. Former CIA officials, former foreign service officers who are saying no, that we have this relationship with radical Islam.
I think it's very easy to comment on that, actually, because there is a sort of military industrial intelligence type complex out there, which is what President Eisenhower warned about in his valedictory speech as president in 1961. And this is hugely beneficial, hugely profit making for some of the global elite. And we've seen globalization take over the world. And we also see that by needing to have enemies, you have to have enemies to feed this sort of military industrial complex. So be it the Soviet Union, be it Al-Qaeda, be it ISIS, be it Russia today, be it Iran today, be it whatever it is, it feeds the machine, which means that these companies, these corporations continue to make huge profits. And they also take away some of our democratic rights in our countries, which are hard won over many centuries. And you know, they see it as a win. But for the rest of us, and particularly for the people across the Middle East who are being ravaged by the violence, which is a result of the humanitarian intervention, or not, by the West, you know, it's a tragedy. So I wouldn't use a bad word, but it is a really bad situation.
And what are your thoughts on the rise of this new media in the rest of the world, in the global South and the East? Russia Today, Press TV in Iran, Telesur and Venezuela, Chinese media. It seems like they're growing rapidly to counter this Western media. And the fact that Russia Today on YouTube was the first channel to receive 1 billion views kind of says something of its appeal and the lack of appeal of Western media.
I think that Russia Today has been very, very clever in the way that they have built up their base by using new technology and putting all the interviews on YouTube. People criticize it and they say it's Russian state propaganda, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, so what the BBC is, Fox News is corporate propaganda. You know, there's always going to be an agenda behind whatever mainstream wing of the media that you speak to. I happen to like Russia. I mean, I speak on the BBC. I've never, ever gone on Fox News. I just want that noted. But I speak on many mainstream media channels too. But it's very difficult to get the interview to put on my website. RT allows me to do that, which is why you see many more of those on my website. But I think that's a very clever move because they're spreading the word. And why the hell should they not promulgate their worldview to try and counterbalance the worldview of the Western countries, particularly America? I mean, you know, Fox News particularly is incredibly odious. It's incredibly damaging. It's incredibly warmongering. And I think looking at the situation at the moment with, you know, flashpoints with Ukraine, between NATO and Russia, with Syria, with Iran, we need all the same words we can get out there rather than just going along with what, you know, some of the corporate media would like us to say. One of the big things over the last few years, last few decades, has been the accumulation of power, the conglomeration of power with a very few huge media corporations around the planet. They control our local media, they control our TV stations, and it's very difficult for people who have an alternative viewpoint to get their words out there. And I think RT is allowing that to happen. Al Jazeera did that for a long time. Press TV from Iran has tried to do that, but of course everyone's very, 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 you know, wary of that. We need to look at plurality. We need to look at plurality of news to try and gauge our own synthesis of what's going on out there.
So what can you tell us about Al-Qaeda 2.0 or ISIS, Daesh, Islamic State? We have the 2012 Department of Defense document that was declassified in which it clearly states that the West with its allies, Qatar, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, are consciously funding the Salafists, the Wahhabists, the Syrian opposition, which naturally also consists of the Islamic State, and wanting to use them to break apart Syria, specifically its eastern province. And we have the Clinton leaks and emails which discuss something similar happening in Libya against Gaddafi.
No, absolutely. I mean, George W. Bush back in 2003 or 2004 actually talked about the axis of evil and the countries that needed to be broken because they were part of that axis. And that was Libya, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and I think North Korea. Now, North Korea is pretty much safe because it's under the patronage of China, which is a nuclear power. North Korea has nukes as well. But pretty much all the other countries have been threatened or broken over the last decade. And the only one that's still standing in any way is Iran. And that's pretty much because of a whistleblower in 2008, where we had a situation where there was a rush to war against Iran. It's a Shia state, not a Sunni state. It's in opposition to Saudi Arabia. It's in opposition to Israel. So Iran was the next in the line. And that was stopped because the defense intelligence estimate of 2008 was leaked. It was written by a guy called Dr. Tom Finger. He said that the Iranians had stopped trying to develop a nuclear weapons capability in 2003, and that was the considered opinion of all 16 of the US intelligence agencies. And because that was leaked, George W. Bush actually had to admit in his biography that stopped the rush to war against Iran. That's the only reason Iran is still standing. So this is frightening. All the other states have been taken over. I mean, look at what happened to Iraq. Look what happened to Libya and Syria. I mean, it's a mess. And this is causing an increasing mess for all our countries too. Well, you know, in Europe and America, there are, you know, terrorist attacks and what have you. And this, again, gives the military intelligence complex a reason to push back and a reason to put more powers in place to enable the intelligence agencies to spy against all of us. So it's a sort of win-win from the American perspective, a win-win from the UK intelligence perspective, which enables the American perspective, but it's a mess for the rest of us.
And what do you think is happening in Syria? We see the Chinese have gotten involved recently, and it seems Russia is drawing the hard red line, and it seems like they're not going to react the same way that they did with Libya. What are your thoughts? I mean, if Syria is overthrown in theory, is the West going to push on to Iran, or are we entering into a very dangerous territory?
I think we are indeed advancing into dangerous territory. So we have a situation where Russia and China did not agree at the UN Security Council about, you know, humanitarian aid, they call it, with Libya, which ended up in the destruction of a very stable and very wealthy country in Africa. And now we have a situation where Iran is effectively a client state of Russia. They are sponsored by Russia. They are supported by Russia on the permanent seat at the UN Council. And of course, Assad, President Assad, has always been a client state of Russia too. So Russia has gone in, and it was the only military intervention that's had any beneficial effect, gave President Assad a fighting chance at the beginning of this year to push back against the so-called moderate rebels as well as ISIS. Now, the so-called moderate rebels are pretty much Al-Qaeda, ISIS anyway, like al-Nusra. So we have a situation where I think China and Russia cannot afford to lose face in this fight. They have to be seen to protect a client state. We have a situation where the US and NATO wants to push hard to get rid of Assad. And the reason they keep sticking on this point is because President Assad is a friend of Russia and China. President Assad is a friend of Iran and trying to build a pipeline from Iran through Syria into Europe to push up the energy that's getting into Europe. I mean, gas, oil, whatever. Russia has been under sanction ever since the Ukraine situation. So what we have now is a sort of Western American view that we have Saudi Arabia and Qatar basically saying, we want to get rid of Assad because we want to build our own pipeline into Europe and undermine the Russian perspective. We want to undermine the Russian business into Europe. And that's what it's all about. So we have America and its allies supporting theocratic dictatorships, which are Saudi and Qatar, to try and build this energy pipeline to funnel Qatar's oil into Europe, Qatar's gas into Europe. And at the same time, trying to, you know, get rid of the Iranian possible pipeline that Russia and China have been facilitating. And this is a geopolitical thing. We have the BRICS grouping, you know, Brazil and Russia and Iran and China, who are all doing actually very well outside the Western hemisphere, the Western sphere. And they are being eroded by this NATO response. And it's all based on energy. And further to that, it's all based on the underlying issue, which is if energy is not traded in petrodollars, which is a monopoly around the planet, which underpins a bankrupt USA, then the USA is in serious trouble. And that's why they're fighting so hard and pushing their NATO allies to fight so hard to get rid of President Assad in Syria.
And what about the global war on terror, which was the first time where we saw NATO invoke Article 5? And this war on terror, they tell us, is, you know, first of all, was because of 9/11, because of Al-Qaeda, because of Saddam, weapons of mass destruction. No, it wasn't because of that. Then it was because of bringing democracy to the Middle East. Now it's because of ISIS. It seems like it can just go on and on and on.
Oh, the global war on terror. It's a wonderful excuse to strip away all our freedoms in all our countries, to spy on all of us, to build this great panopticon of surveillance, which is what Edward Snowden has laid bare. There's no doubt about it. Now, we have a situation where the US has since, well, for years, for decades, pressed for global hegemony. And they, first of all, of course, used the war on drugs as a means of stripping away privacy, you know, and constitutional rights in their own country, and illegally invading other countries, particularly in Latin America and Mexico and around the world. Now, actually, what they've got is the global war on terror, which means it's, you know, it's that with bells on. They can do whatever they want, and they have done over the last few years. And they are acting as war criminals around the planet, you know, with kidnapping so-called terrorist suspects, with torturing them, with holding them illegally for years in black sites, like Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that is effectively a black site. I mean, everyone knew about it, but it's a black site. It is an illegal site. So we have seen stripping away of all the provisions that were put in place post the Second World War in the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights. And we've done that because of this nebulous, ever-changing, ever-expanding war on terror, because the Americans were hit on 9/11. I mean, that is just amazing, considering everything else that's gone on around the planet and what the Americans have done on ever since.
You mentioned Guantanamo, and I don't think we even have to go that far, because I was born in Chicago, and it was reported last year that a black site was discovered where the Chicago police renditioned 7,000 American citizens, mostly blacks and Hispanics, but Caucasians as well. So it seems it's happening everywhere.
I read about that. Yes, that was disgusting. But this is the whole point. This is why. Sorry, just one final point. This is why the fight for basic human rights and civil liberties is so important. This has been going on, well, I mean, you know, for hundreds of years, certainly in Western Europe. It was transplanted to the US. And they wrote this wonderful constitution that was supposed to protect, well, at least men of white colour. Women and other people didn't really count. But the point is, the fundamental issue about human rights, you know, you are not going to be extrajudicially murdered. You're not going to be tortured. You're not going to be raped. You're not going to be whatever. And suddenly all this is going because of the war on terror. How is this such a special thing just because America got hit by one attack? I mean, it was an awful attack, I agree. But, you know, many other countries have suffered that, and many other countries are suffering that because of America's retaliation with drone strikes and illegal torture and things. Oh, it's getting a balance. You know, we're losing sight of the fight for what our ancestors won across the Western world. And that makes me so sad.
And what of the surveillance state, the Panopticon, Big Brother, NSA, GCHQ, the Five Eyes? It seems most people aren't bothered about it, or at least most people who don't have a long view of history. What is there to fear of the surveillance state?
Huge. Of course. I mean, I've spoken about this so many times, but I mean, the very basic thing is, if you think you are always being watched, if you think you're always being listened to, what you search for on the internet, what you read, what you download, whatever, is being monitored, then you start to self-censor. And that is the first step towards death of democracy, death to freedom of speech. Because if you cannot express yourself or inform yourself, that is the end of meaningful participation as citizens. It's simple. It's that simple. And then, you know, what Edward Snowden, for example, expressed and exposed was, you know, even things like video conferencing on Skype, which, of course, is not working for us tonight. But even that could be live monitored by the spies. And apparently about 10% of those sort of conversations tend to be between long distance couples who are quite explicit, should we say, in their video Skypes. So, you know, most people say, I'm doing nothing wrong, I have nothing to hide. But I bet most people would like to hide that from the spies.
And regarding current events and international affairs, what is at the forefront of your mind? What are you most worried about?
Obviously Syria is the big thing. Well, I'm British, there's Brexit as well, but, you know. I think what's worrying me most is the ongoing provocation, needless provocation of Russia. We had President Poroshenko Poroshenko in Ukraine today saying that Russia's about to launch a full-on invasion of Ukraine? No. There have been all these war games on the border in Poland and in Latvian states over the last few months. And that does worry me, because Russia is a nuclear power. They have obviously been evolving over the last 15 years with their weaponry and things. They are pretty closely allied to another major, huge nuclear power, China. And if the neoliberals in America, the neocons in America, keep prodding the bear, eventually at some point the bear is going to retaliate. And I really hope they don't. But, I mean, I think they've been very restrained so far. I mean, for the last 25 years. But I'm slightly worried about that, should we say.
And now we have a question from a brave soul, a student. And I'm going to ask the podcast listeners to forgive me because we had a technical issue with the microphone and the student's mic is a bit low.
Hi, Ms. Machon. Pleased to have you today. And I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, this whole, like, addressing international issues through a less academic or mainstream perspective is completely new for me. So when I was reading about your experience in the MI5, I found it to be really, really interesting. And all these questions kind of emerged, one of them being, how long did it take for you after realizing that the MI6 was involved in funding Gaddafi's assassination? How long did it take for you to actually take the decision to put that to public light? Or what was the first, and also, what was the first thought to cross your mind when you found out all these disclosed information?
That's a good question. In fact, it was my former partner, David Shaler, who was the head of the Libyan section in MI5, who was briefed officially about this by his counterparts in MI6. So he was the one who told me, and he just said, you know, we can't be involved in organization like this. I mean, we've seen so many other things going wrong by that point anyway, but that was the sort of the thing that, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. That's why we had to get out, because we didn't want to be part of an intelligence community that was, it was a state-funded terrorism attack. So that's why we left. So it was David being briefed about it, David telling me about it, and a lot of discussion. It was quite a frightening decision to take, though, I have to say. There were, you know, a number of weeks of discussion. And then it also took a number of months of discussion between David and the journalist who eventually broke the story, because both were mutually suspicious of each other. So it was quite a slow process and very stressful.
And that's a good segue into my final question, but I thought I'd comment first with an observation where I feel, you know, we mentioned how the media and the rest of the world seems to be growing and having more power and impact. I also feel in academia and education around the world that the traditional narrative, the status quo, the Western narrative of how the way the world works is being challenged as well. You know, here in Mexico, I have this freedom to assign a textbook such as yours, whereas other institutions I might not. And so there seems to be hope.
I think so, yes. And this is why the internet is so, you know, the internet needs to be free. That it's got to be net neutrality, where no corporation can have the high speed connection and the rest of us are all buried. Where Google doesn't build a knowledge vault, where websites or opinions that are deemed to be unacceptable by some nebulous force are buried in the Google searches. This is why we need proper, free internet. This is the promise of it. And this is what has brought about so much of what we do now and so many questions that all of us are asking about what's going on. On really in world politics, rather than just our parents reading a newspaper or watching the evening news, and that's the only information they had, and that's so easily manipulated. And that's what's at risk at the moment, both in Europe and the rest of the world. I mean, I was very, very intrigued after the Snowden disclosures, the early ones in 2013, where Brazil immediately said, we're going to build our own infrastructure to connect with Europe on the internet. We're going to put our, you know, all our, you know, fiber optic cables and do it ourselves rather than going through the US. I thought that was absolutely the right move. And lo and behold, there's a neoliberal coup, an impeachment against the democratically elected president, blah, blah, blah. It's always interesting to follow these things.
And the final question that I always ask my guests is, for students, for the inquisitive citizen, for anyone trying to decipher world events, what advice would you give them in doing so?
Well, don't get depressed, first. And secondly, read around every subject. Look at multiple sources. You need to look at multiple sources, because if you just read one or one expert, whatever it is, don't trust me, read around what I say as well. And then you can make your own judgment, and that's the important thing. But then also think about what meaningful action you can take. And I still have faith that people can democratically hassle their MPs, their representatives, whatever, try and make a difference, but realistically understand the constraints of the system. And perhaps then think about tooling up technologically, you know, use privacy tools that, you know, like Tor or Tails or encryption when you're emailing to ensure your own privacy, because you can't guarantee your governments can do that. Then at least that gives you a fighting chance if you ever want to fight back.
That'll do it for this edition of the podcast. You can go visit our guest at her website, anniemichon.ch. Follow her on Twitter and donate to her as well if you can, so she can continue her brave, courageous, and important work. Don't forget to visit us at GuadalajaraGeopolitics.com. Like, follow, and subscribe to our channels, and we'll see you next time.